private passions, a word from Joan Bakewell.
This Christmas series of Belief explores a rich and varied tapestry of world views. The novelist and actor Stella Duffy explains how the practice of Nichiren Buddhism has sustained her for 25 years. Biologist Rupert Sheldrake tells me why he's at odds with many in the scientific community. The editor of a glossy lifestyle magazine created for Muslims, Sarah Joseph, explains her own conversion. The former Bishop of Oxford, the Reverend Richard Harris, talks about his failed attempt to make a gay cleric, Geoffrey John, a bishop. And Melvin Bragg offers his insights into the impulse of creativity, both his own and others. Theirs are among the voices you'll hear in this season's series of Belief, starting tomorrow at 9:30.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's just after 12 noon and time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Andrew Lloyd Webber scarcely needs introduction. He's the creator of a quite extraordinary list of hit musicals. Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, Jesus Christ Superstar, Evita, Cats, Starlight Express, Phantom of the Opera, and recently Love Never Dies. Now, normally on this programme, we tend to avoid classical musicians simply because, well, music obviously is their passion. It's a public passion rather than a private one. But just every now and then, we like to buck the trend, and this is Christmas Day, so we thought we'd do something special and find out the private passions, what drives a successful composer to write what he does, and see if we could actually just find the touchstone of his musical sensibility. In your case, Andrew, I think listening to the music, I do quite often think I know the composers that must have influenced you, especially from the point of view of orchestration and theatre. But, of course, you did come from a very musical family.
Yes, my father was the director of the London College of Music and was the senior professor of composition at the Royal College for a long time. My mother was a piano teacher who seems to have taught an awful lot of children who I still seem to meet. But yes, it was a very musical family, and my brother was a cellist, and we also had John Lill, the pianist, living in our house as well. So I have to say, well, God help the neighbours, really, yeah. Because we were all making music.
How did you come to go off at a particular slant from the sort of straight classical music to writing shows? I mean, was it just chance?
Well, I suppose one of the things, I mean, my father had a very, what you might call, Catholic taste in music. I remember him once coming in with the Shadows, Frigid of the Shadows, with their Frightened City, and saying, right now, he said, these are probably the best quartet working in Britain musically. And I'm thinking, Dad, what are you talking about? But he didn't mind my listening to all sorts of pop. In fact, he tried to get me to, when I was sort of underage, to go to the cinema, tried to sneak me into Jailhouse Rock, I remember, the movie. So it wasn't sort of as if it was frowned on in any way, but I just loved the theatre. I had an aunt who worked in the theatre, and I met lots of people who I thought were frightfully glamorous. I mean, I met people like Vida Hope, who directed The Boyfriend when I was eight, you know, and she came to a silly little musical that I put on in my toy theatre, all that sort of thing. So theatre was really always in my lifeblood, absolutely. I mean, I remember the first thing I ever saw was can't think why it was in the Adelphi Theatre, but it was, and it was La Bohème. And I remember, as we'll come to later, it just made a huge impression on me. That was the first theatre I ever saw. And the second was My Fair Lady.
And then I imagine sort of Joseph just propelled you onto the road you were about to take.
Well, Joseph really came about because at that time, I had met Tim Rice. The first show we'd written together, which was a musical about the life of Dr. Bernardo, a bad subject, really, it didn't get on. And we were asked by the music master at St. Paul's Junior School if we would write a piece for the kids' end-of-term concert. And the brief was to find something which all of the kids could take part in or play or do something. And Joseph was the result. It was performed on a rather wet Friday afternoon to an audience of surprised and rather bored parents. And it went from there, grew like Topsy, but it was originally only 25 minutes long.
We always like to, when we have a musician on, begin with something of yours, perhaps something you've done recently. What would you choose?
Well, I quite like to choose Love Never Dies itself from the show, the same name. Catherine Jenkins did a very pretty version of it, and maybe we can hear her.
Oh, no. One day it's simply there, alive inside your heart. It slips into your thoughts, it infiltrates your soul. It takes you by surprise, then seizes full control. Try to deny it and try to protest, but love won't let you go once you've been possessed. Love never dies. Love never falters. Once it has spoken, love is yours.
Catherine Jenkins singing Love Never Dies. Andrew, you've talked about your theatrical experience very early on with Boheme and Puccini. But, of course, another composer who's been terribly important to you, I think, is Prokofiev.
Yes, Prokofiev, Shostakovich, a huge influence on me. I think perhaps because as John Lill was living in the house and he was learning Prokofiev. And Cinderella was a piece that I always loved. The theatricality and the slightly bonkers theatricality too. I mean, no other composer other than Prokofiev would have the clock chiming all 12 midnight. I mean, you can't not smile when you listen to Prokofiev. And then, of course, he ends after the clock's chimed 12. He comes up with this wonderful melody, which, I mean, quite honestly, you know, you see that there's Tchaikovsky in him as well.
Thank you. wonderful imagination at work there.
It's extraordinary. I don't think any other composer would actually do that with a wood block and everything. I mean, that last tune is one of the great melodies of all time. I think Prokofiev really is up there. I mean, if you think of the 20th century composers, he has to be in the top four melodists, really, doesn't he?
We heard the Cleveland Orchestra, conducted by Vladimir Ashkenazy, with music from the end of Act Two of Cinderella. Andrew, do you think you subconsciously, I mean, I, as a composer, think one does, take in sort of orchestrational devices and things that you like, that just because they're surrounding you, you hear them. So it's not always that it's just a lesson, but you just think, oh, you like that, and then you look to see how it's done.
It is a funny thing, isn't it? Because I did learn orchestration. I did a short course at the Guildhall for a year. But I think, like so much within music, you do sort of evolve, don't you? There are sounds that you particularly like, and you learn the sort of tricks with it, which, because orchestration is very, very important. I mean, as we all know, I mean, it can make or break something. I mean, orchestration, of course, there's nobody better, really, than Benjamin Britten. One of the reasons I wanted to play something from Peter Grimes is because the C interludes there are absolutely astonishing, because they tell you that, I mean, for some reason, you know it's Suffolk, you know it's the coast. And the colours that Britten uses, I think, in orchestration are probably unequalled, you know. And I think if you were really wanting to think about orchestration in musical theatre, start and finish with Benjamin Britten in a way. It's just the colour and the texture and how evocative he makes everything.
Thank you. Dawn from the Sea Interludes from Peter Grimes, Opus 33, by Benjamin Britten, the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Stuart Bedford. Andrew, just before we come on to Puccini, can I ask you a little bit about your great love of Pre-Raphaelites, of which you've got an extraordinary and wonderful collection? And because I wonder whether there's any connection between that particular period in a funny way, or that aesthetic, and the music you like.
I don't know. I kind of keep music and my art collecting rather apart. I think artists and architecture really is my other first love, and I could have easily gone, I think, down that path or become some sort of architectural historian or critic or something. That is what I love. I mean, I've just been in Manchester, you know, the chance to go and see churches and buildings again, which one had not seen for ages. The Ford Madox Brown exhibition, which is still on, so go. Really, really wonderful. And I don't know, I think it probably might have been, though, because, you know, like all kids, you rebel a bit, don't you? And our art master at school hated the Pre-Raphaelites. I mean, loathed them. So every art essay I did, I said, of course, only this artist had learned from Millet's The Huguenot, you know, knowing that I get gamma minus. You know? One thing which he couldn't stand, which might partly answer your question, is that I once put my hand up in the class and said, something I don't get. I said, why is it that round the corner of the Tate Gallery, that the only gallery that seems to me to be constantly full is the Pre-Raphaelite one? And there's no answer to that, really. They were so unfashionable, and they still are. A lot of people in the art world regard them as a complete aberration and a sort of strange tangent. I don't. I just saw this gorgeous Rossetti drawing in Manchester this last time. They're not displaying at the moment, for shame. But the draftsmanship in there is just staggering. I suppose maybe the storytelling ingredient in there is another thing that appeals to me, but not necessarily.
I can see those cross-references, though.
Yeah, I just happened to love them. I happened to have got... And what's the other thing was, is at the time, they were about the only pictures around that you could afford, because they were valueless. I remember seeing Flaming June, which is not, of course, Pre-Raphaelite, but by Lord Leighton, in a junk shop in the Fulham Road at £50. I asked my granny if I could have the money to buy it. Of course, I didn't know it could have easily not been Flaming June. It could have been a copy, because it's filthy dirty. But it was. It was it. And when it came back to England, it's now in Puerto Rico, I know what the Tate Gallery had on the insurance figure on that, and it certainly wasn't £50.
Well, Andrew Lloyd, we're going to unleash you now on Puccini. And curiously enough, you know, I actually once found a bit of Puccini in Peter Grimes.
Yes.
So I think his influence extends far and wide. I think anybody that knows anything about the theatre has to recognise in Puccini kind of master of that.
I think, I mean, I'm often asked, what do you need to know about if you want to write a musical? And I'd said, you can't teach it, but if you really, really, really want to simplify it into the most kind of banal form, just look, well, not banal, because it's not, but the Act Two of La Bohème is probably the greatest piece of musical compression and dramatic compression in anything in the theatre. I can't think of anything. So if you listen to Act Two of Bohème and you listen to Some Enchanted Evening by Richard Rodgers, you've got a pretty good start to understand how to write for musical theatre, I think. A little bit of Bernstein's allowed as well, West Side Story. Sadly, we won't be able to play all of the second act, but it's just the way he uses colours, he throws the ear all the time, when that little child comes in with that little phrase, la-da-da-da-da-da-da, completely atonal, actually, to the rest of the whole thing, but it just works, and then how he finally brings everybody together with his big tune.
This is a rather appropriate choice, actually, because I think it takes place in the cafe on Christmas Eve.
Indeed it does, a most wonderful, colourful scene in the theatre. But we're joining it, I think, halfway through for Musetta's waltz, when all the young bohemians are trying to con an old man into paying their dinner. I think that's the plot in its simplest way, and rather successfully, because Musetta pretends that she has a pain in her shoe, and her shoe's too tight, and under the cover of all of this, they slope off, leaving the old man with the bill, whilst you name it is going on stage.
Quella gente che dirà che da sapore. Thank you.
It's wonderful the way he weaves it all together.
I remember once hearing an extraordinary cafe arrangement of Bohème in Venice, and I asked the band leader who did it. And it was Puccini. And the band leader told me that what, in fact, used to happen was is that Puccini would do these cafe arrangements because his operas tended to get pretty awful reviews. And he blitzed the cafes with all of these arrangements. And apparently the sad thing is that they were all lost when the recording offices were bombed. So this particular person, his grandfather, had copies of these because he was an old band leader and he was in the family. So he had the parts. It just shows you, doesn't it, that nothing really changes and that, of course, I suppose getting your music heard in the cafes in those days was the same as getting it played on the radio.
We heard music from Act Two of Puccini's La Bohème. That was the Scholte recording with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, the John Aldiss Choir and the Wandsworth School Boys, and it featured, of course, Domingo, Caballé, Cheryl Mills. Judith Bingham sang Musetta's song. You had, I think, the a privilege, Andrew Lloyd Webber, of meeting Shostakovich, but perhaps not in circumstances that we would have expected.
Well, Shostakovich came over for the World Cup. Maybe it wasn't the World Cup, maybe it was the European Cup or something. But anyway, it was around about 1972-3, because he went to see Jesus Christ Superstar, about which I was very flattered, and he wanted to meet me afterwards, and basically we ended up talking about football, didn't talk about music at all. He was, along with Prokofiev, I think, a huge influence on me, and the cello concerto, I suppose, because my brother was learning it at the time when I was still living at home, and of course Rostropovich, that recording was a sort of the recording in the day. And I just always loved it because it always struck me that it was a rock and roll piece masquerading. I mean, all those wonderful da-da-da-ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da
And it's also got, you know, we were talking about that flattened third thing.
Yes. Oh, well, I mean, it was great. Starts in it.
And Rostropovich, by the way, the string hit the bow.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I did meet Rostropovich a couple of times, and I think one of the most extraordinary nights I ever remember in music at all was when he played the Dvorak in the Albert Hall on the night that the Russians invaded Czechoslovakia. I mean, it was quite extraordinary because, I mean, he could hardly get through it.
Thank you.
You're absolutely right. I can almost see Mick Jagger prancing around to that.
It's just pure rock riff, isn't it? And then it comes back on the cello. You do think when you hear that, gosh, I presume he was playing on a Strad or something. Wasn't built for that, was it?
And I think the first horn has a stiff drink afterwards.
Yes, I would think.
The first movement from the Cello Concerto No. 1 in E-flat major, opus 107, by Shostakovich, played by Mstislav Rostropovich with the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Eugene Ormandy. It's quite extraordinary when you think of the composers that wrote for the theatre around that period. If you think, as we've talked earlier about Tchaikovsky, Prokofiev, Shostakovich, Stravinsky, and really they wrote the best ballet scores ever written, didn't they?
I agree. I wish I'd chosen some Stravinsky or The Rite of Spring in this, but time.
You can't have everything.
I have to make a choice, but I agree with you. And it's a very rich period, and of course, as was the American musical theatre in sort of the 40s and 50s. I mean, I've often thought how wonderful it must have been to be working then, because you had Richard Rodgers, Frank Loesser, you know, Leonard Bernstein, Sondheim beginning, of course, Irving Berlin. You know, I mean, the list is endless. And, of course, what I guess happened was everybody started to raise their game, because sometimes I feel that we in musical theatre today got a bit of a vacuum. I would just love it if there was three hugely successful young composers came out now who really, really were strong melodists, because that's what we kind of need, I think. Then everybody raises their game. Because you get excited. And I mean, I've chosen a bit from West Side Story, because I think in many ways West Side Story is probably my favourite musical, even though I think Richard Rodgers would be my favourite theatre composer. I thought we had to have a bit from West Side, because that really genuinely did change the course of where musicals were going, and probably hasn't really been equaled since.
Thank you.
Very sassy, isn't it?
It's very, very clever and, again, fabulously theatrical. Mm. It must have been a most astonishing moment when that burst loose. But, you know, it's a funny old world, isn't it? Mm. You think West Side Story was the great big winner of everything and everybody would think it didn't win the Tony Award for Best Musical that year.
Mm. That was the prologue from West Side Story, the original soundtrack recording conducted by Johnny Green of the Bernstein School. Another composer, Andrew, who had an absolutely natural lyrical gift, and again from Russia, is Rachmaninoff.
Yes, and Rachmaninoff was a huge favourite of my father. My father particularly loved the songs. I mean, I think he liked anything which a young soprano got at. But I myself have always had a very, very soft spot for this wonderful song, which is called, not very nicely called, I always think in English, How Fair This Spot. I don't think it's, I prefer to do it in the Russian. It's a beautiful, beautiful melody. And my former wife, Sarah Brightman, used to sing this. And I sort of really learned it through her. Wonderful tune, and we always think of Rachmaninoff as through the piano concertos and everything, but forget, of course, that he wrote a huge amount of choral music and opera, of course, too.
It occurred to me as we were listening to that, Andrew, that the thing about a sort of lyric gift we talked about the simplicity, but also it has a kind of inevitability, doesn't it? A lyrical line where it just seems to fall quite naturally.
Well, that is almost completely perfect, isn't it? I mean, it's just everything just follows, as you say. Yeah, you wonder whether did he compose that in one go? I wonder, but I mean, just the way he brings the orchestra back with the opening phrase at the end there, and it does seem inevitable. You're right. You think that there isn't another way of doing it.
How Fair This Spot, from 12 Songs, Opus 21, number 7 by Rachmaninoff. We heard Anna Netrebko singing with the orchestra of the Mariinsky Theatre, conducted by Valery Gergiev. Now, I imagine that this takes us back to the Lloyd Webber household early on, because I can imagine that if John Lyle was practising this next piece, it would be pretty unforgettable.
I remember that John learnt this, and I turned the pages for him, on a family holiday in Norfolk. And it's the Rakoffi of Seventh Piano Sonata, Last Movement, which, of course...
You're probably turning the pages pretty quickly.
Well, I'm not sure whether it's more difficult to follow the pages or whether to play it. But this is a fabulous piece, because, I mean, it talk about pure rock and roll, but, I mean, it's a 7/8 time, and you can't follow it. I mean, just try, from the beginning of this, to keep the 7 in your head all the way through and see how long you can keep it, because I can't keep it going for very long. But when it finally comes out at the end, I mean, it's one of the great... great show pieces for the piano.
And played by someone like Marta Argerich, who brings great fire to everything she does anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
It's hysterical and hysterically funny in a way.
It is funny. I mean, how do you follow that? There's nothing you can do, is there really? But it's just wonderful. I mean, that again, the rhythm and the. I mean, it's what Prokofiev, of course, is so fabulous when he's all the cross rhythms and motor rhythms and everything.
And I imagine, because he was a good, very good pianist himself, yeah. I imagine he enjoyed having that as a sort of showpiece.
He must have done. It has to be written for him, doesn't it? I imagine, but it just always makes me smile. And my goodness, she takes me quite fast, doesn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah. And almost flies off the end.
Yes, it does.
Actually, if one's honest. But that's what live performance is all about, isn't it?
Yeah. You know,
taking risks.
So. I think so. Somebody should do a ballet of that.
Mm. Yeah.
Be very interesting.
Yes. Marta Argerich played the third movement from the Piano Sonata No. 7 in B-flat major, Opus 83, by Prokofiev. We're going to finish, Andrew Lloyd Webber, with one of your very favourite writers of musicals.
Yes.
Marvellous tune, of course.
I mean, Richard Rodgers, again, along with Prokofiev, were right up there as the greatest melodist. I would have thought, put in Paul McCartney, because he definitely yeah. was, and Gershwin, and you're sort of more or less there. But Rodgers, I mean, he had these two stars, too. I mean, when he worked with Lawrence Hart, his musical style was really quite different to what happened when he started to work with Hammerstein with Oklahoma. And yet, everything about him is so simple, but it's so completely original. And, I mean, Some Enchanted Evening, which I've chosen now, has to be one of the greatest melodies ever written.
Some enchanted evening you may see a stranger. You may see a stranger across a crowded room. Somehow you know even then, that somewhere you'll see her again and again. Some enchanted evening, someone may be laughing. You may hear her laughing across a crowded room. And night after night, as strange as it seems, the sound of her laughter will sing in your dreams. Explain it, who can tell you why? Fools give you reasons, wise men never try. Some enchanted evening, when you find your true love, when you fly to her side and make her your own. For all through your life you may dream all alone. Once you have found her, never let her go. Once you have found her, never let her go.
Giorgio Tozzi singing Some Enchanted Evening from South Pacific by Rodgers and Hammerstein. Thank you very much, Andrew, for introducing us to these pieces that you've loved so much. I wonder, you've conquered the world of the musical, you've written a requiem. I wonder where you feel, and you've actually conquered difficult illness too. I wonder where you feel your musical palette is going to take you next.
I don't know. I'm looking for a subject to write at the moment, and I haven't found anything that I particularly want to do. I found some things I sort of started, you know, and you begin to read and you think, yeah, I could do that. But then I hit a bit of a bump with all of the stories I found. So I've got a whole lot of melodies at the moment, just sort of sitting like little waifs and strays, as it were, in my bottom drawer. They're homeless. That's very sad. I feel very sorry for them.
Because it is difficult, isn't it, that thing of finding a subject that really kind of floats your boat, as it were.
It is. It is much more difficult. And I have, you know, in the last 10 years, I suppose, done a couple of things, really, because I just wanted to work, and I probably shouldn't have done them. But on the other hand, maybe it's time to do something completely different. I just don't know. The funny thing about musicals, though, you can just think, well, I can't find anything, just don't know what to do. And then somebody gives you a book or an idea, like The Phantom of the Opera. I always thought it was a terrible idea for a musical until I happened to find the book in a second-hand bookshop in New York. And I read it in the afternoons. I had nothing better to do. And I found it there for, literally for 25 cents or something. And I thought to myself, this is a rather flawed book, but my goodness, this could make a wonderful high romance. Ran into Hal Prince that night, said, I'm thinking about doing a musical of The Phantom of the Opera. What do you think? He said, I'd like to do it. And that's how that happened. I mean, honestly, the morning I woke up that day, the last thing in the world I thought I would be talking to a great director in New York about The Phantom of the Opera. And it just happens. You can never tell, so I'm not completely despondent. I'm just bored.
Thank you so much, and happy Christmas.
Thank you, same to you.
Andrew Lloyd Webber was talking to Michael Barclay in this week's edition of Private Passions. There's no Private Passions next week, but on Sunday the 8th of January, Michael's guest will be the ballerina Tamara Rocco, who is about to star in Romeo and Juliet at the Royal Opera House Covent Garden. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's edition was Sarah Cropper.
Every summer in Germany, the Castle of Schwetzingen plays host to the classical music stars of today and of tomorrow in a revered music festival that has taken place since 1952. In the Radio 3 lunchtime concert over Christmas and New Year, you can hear 9 recitals from the 2011 Schwetzingen Festival. Music of all shapes and sizes. Weekdays from Tuesday at 1 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
Well, if you've recently tuned in, welcome from me, Jonathan Swain, and a very happy Christmas to you. At 2 o'clock this afternoon, we're at the Chapel of King's College, Cambridge, for a festival of 9 lessons and carols. And in just a couple of minutes, a Christmas anthology in the Early Music Show. Coming up to 1 minute past one, and it's time for the news read by John Shea.
There's been a series of bomb attacks on churches in Nigeria. Reports from the capital, Abuja, say at least 25 people died in a blast outside a Roman Catholic church. The Islamist Boko Haram group is reported to have admitted carrying out the attack. There were also explosions in the cities of Jos and Damaturu. Members of the royal family will visit Prince Philip in hospital in Cambridgeshire this afternoon as he continues to recover from a heart operation. This morning they attended the traditional Christmas church service at Sandringham. Buckingham Palace says the Duke of Edinburgh is eager to leave hospital. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, has warned that riots and the greed of city bankers have left Britain's communities spinning apart in the dark. Delivering his Christmas Day sermon, Dr. Williams said that bonds had been broken and trust had been abused and lost. He urged the congregation at Canterbury Cathedral to learn lessons about mutual obligation from the events of the past year. The Pope has delivered his Christmas blessing to thousands of people gathered in St. Peter's Square. Addressing the crowds from a balcony, Pope Benedict prayed for the victims of conflict, famine and floods around the world. He also urged the international community to help those suffering from hunger in eastern Africa, called for an end to the violence in Syria, and said he hoped that the Arab Spring would benefit the common good. The Afghan government says at least 10 people have been killed in a suicide bomb attack at a funeral ceremony in the northeast of the country. The explosion happened in the city of Taligan as mourners were leaving the service. A member of the Afghan parliament was among the dead. And the weather. Northern Ireland is experiencing its warmest Christmas day on record, with temperatures reaching almost 14 degrees Celsius in County Down. It'll be dry and cloudy for most. Heavy rain will continue across western Scotland. and similar conditions will continue overnight with mild temperatures. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at exactly 3 minutes past one.
And it was read by John Shea. Well, time now to join Catherine Bott for the early music show, when the programme starts with music from Schütz's Christmas Concerto.
Concerto Vocale, directed by René Jacobs, with some joyful tidings set to music by Heinrich Schütz in the 1630s. Today, Christ the Lord is born. We're on to our ninth Christmas here at the Early Music Show, and over the years we've always made sure to come up with something festive, original, and of course historically informed. There are lots of nativity-related topics worth a look, and indeed we've visited many of them. Blessed Christmastide versus pagan Yule, the origins of carols, the disgraceful goings-on at the Feast of Fools. But today, I'm just going to stick close to the Gospels of Saints Matthew and Luke, and with the help of some glorious music from several centuries, celebrate what John Betjeman's poem Christmas calls this most tremendous tale of all. Let's begin with the Orlando Consort and the anonymous 14th century account of the angel Gabriel sent from God unto a city of Galilee named Nazareth.